It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore a new collection of prose poems from Madison poet Cynthia Marie Hoffman. Her works chronicle her childhood onset of obsessive-compulsive disorder and that journey into adulthood with an anxiety disorder causing repeated unwanted thoughts and fears. Be part of this conversation. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Cynthia Marie Hoffman's poetry collection is called Exploding Head. Cynthia, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. So your collection is split into four sections. The first section is from the perspective of a child. Did any of these events you write about happen in your childhood, or are they artistic metaphors about your childhood?
Oh, this is such a funny question, because actually my father read the poems just recently, last fall, when the advanced reading copy was out, and he said, well, I hope you imagined most of these things. I hope these are metaphors, but no, these are actually the thoughts that were going through my head at the time. It's quite scary to be a child with OCD when you have fears that come out of nowhere.
How did you, document those fears as a child? Did you just hold them through the years and then they come later in life pouring out through poetry as you become a poet? Or how did you hold on to these?
Exactly. I did hold on to them. I didn't tell anyone. And I think it was because a lot of the obsessions that can come with OCD aren't the types of things that it's okay to talk about generally in conversations. Fears of getting shot, or fears that someone will break into your home, worrying constantly about being in a car accident. These things are just brushed off by others as, don't worry about it. You know, it makes you feel like, especially when you're a child, you're the only one having these types of thoughts. No one else seems concerned. So there must be something wrong with me. And I decided that certainly if there was anything wrong with me, I was going to keep it secret. So I actually started writing about OCD when I was already about 35. And it was really the first time I had spoken more publicly, you know, with my poetry group around the dining room table in my own home, but to people that weren't my close family. And everything did sort of come spilling out through poetry. It gave me a way of speaking about things in an artistic platform that I had full control over, that space on the page. And it just felt like it was a way for me to express those things that I didn't have another outlet to express them in.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, did you feel any stigma or shame as you sat around your poetry circle at the table in talking about something so deeply personal as this anxiety disorder?
I think I worried that I would feel that way, but my poetry group was such a supportive group and collection of peers, and they really made me feel comfortable. When I first brought the poems, I said, I'm writing about something new, but I don't want to talk about what it is. I just want the poems to speak for themselves. I wasn't quite ready to say, I have OCD, this is OCD. I just wanted to show a bare, clean, non-labeled look inside my mind.
There are images and themes that come up through the collection, including an angel. What is the angel you write about?
The angel was actually a figure that appeared in my room when I was a little child. I'm not sure where he came from. Of course, I did go to Sunday school when I was a kid. I went to church. There was some religion in my house. So it obviously came from that. The idea of angels always fascinated me when I was little. I wanted to have an angel costume and dress up as an angel at Christmas. But this angel figure was not a guardian angel for me. It was something that was terrifying. And I just felt the presence of him standing there at night by my closet door. You know, as kids are afraid of things in the dark, I was afraid of an angel. And I had in my mind the idea that this angel, if I didn't cover my ear with the sheet at night, my ear was bare, the angel would approach my bed and lean over and whisper the secret of heaven. And I don't know why this was scary to me. And that's why I think that the angel got wrapped up in the idea of OCD for me. As I thought about what are my OCD symptoms, the angel seemed to be a part of that because there were these strange rules that were just there. They were associated with this angel. I had to cover my ear.
We're talking with Madison-based poet Cynthia Marie Hoffman, a new book of poetry. It's called Exploding Head. You can join in with questions and comments at any point, 800-642-1234. Cynthia, you establish a pattern of thought that you characterize as a game and rules. And in your poem, Conquerors, you write, you have your own game and you must play it quietly in your mind. And the rules are, if you don't count, you'll die. What did you mean by the game and the rules?
I guess it sounds a little bit like the childhood game of step on a crack and break your mother's back. OCD comes just assigned with these rules. If I do X, I'll be protected by Y. And so I think ultimately I was afraid of dying and still am. I want to live. I love my family. I love my life. I want to be alive and enjoy it. And so that's my biggest fear. It wraps up in everything. And OCD clamps itself onto whatever your biggest fear is, whatever you don't want to lose. And for me, I think just at a base level, that's my life. And I think that just the rules coming in quietly in my mind represented the idea that I had to keep it secret, that I didn't do anything really that was physically visible. Like I wasn't walking through a door 15 times to get out the door in the morning to school, things like that, that other people would notice. It was all internal, these mental compulsions to count and draw patterns on things, all in my head quietly.
You know, when I think of Conquer, it's the British game using those little horse chestnut tree seeds and that idea of you strike the opponent's conquer and try to break it. Did you feel like there were these instances where things or people were striking out at you and trying to break you in some way?
I don't think so. I don't think others were trying to break me, but I think that it was the idea of breaking something open. I was fascinated by what's hidden inside. And you're right, Conquers is that British game. I lived in England when I was little, and my sister and I played Conquers. We loved it. It was so fun. And I kept the title in the book, even though I thought people might not know in the US what Conquers is. So I'm glad you know that game. And I think that it was just, you know, the idea of holding so much inside and a fascination with how that might be eventually broken open.
Madison poet Cynthia Marie Hoffman, new collection of poems. It's called Exploding Head, Navigating a Life with Obsessive Compulsive Disorder. Call in with a question. You can share your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
The people of Wisconsin.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss a new collection of image-rich poems called Exploding Head that give a glimpse of what it's like to live with obsessive-compulsive disorder, which the National Institutes of Health characterizes as uncontrollably recurrent thoughts, known as obsessions, and repetitive behaviors, referred to as compulsions. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective, 800-642-1234. This is the fourth poetry collection by Cynthia Marie Hoffman of Madison. Let's bring in a call now, Jenny in Evansville. Jenny, hi, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to say how much I appreciate the topic. I was diagnosed with OCD when I was about 20, and I'm 50 years old now, so I guess I just want to underscore the fact that OCD is a very unique journey. It differs so much from person to person. Mine in particular manifested with germs. And today I am very high functioning. I still very much live with it. It's just a part of me that I've come to accept. I'll have business meetings and be in all sorts of situations, and no one around me knows that I'm functioning with a certain set of rules. So, it's something that I don't hide it, but I also don't want it to be the focus. And so when I do confide in someone new and explain to them, I have this characteristic or this disorder, the first thing that they usually start doing is trying to accommodate for it. Oh, well, does this bother you? Does that bother you? And
how does that make you feel?
I'm the kind of person that I like to make the people around me feel at ease. And so I have learned to be very careful who I share that with. And it needs to be someone whom I can trust, so that I can say to them, look, I will let you know.
Yeah.
Please do not try. I think the hard thing is they have empathy and they want to try to accommodate. But what they don't understand, it is absolutely not rational. For example, I can drink out of a coffee mug in a restaurant, but I cannot drink out of a glass.
Jenny, I really appreciate you sharing your very personal journey with OCD. And Cynthia Marie Hoffman, what comes up as you hear Jenny's story?
Oh, thank you so much, Jenny, for sharing. All of that rung true for me, especially the loneliness when you're keeping something inside. And even if you aren't attempting to hide it or trying to not show your OCD, it's a very isolating disorder. And people who have OCD who have read my book say that the main thing that I think rang true for them was especially the childhood section, where it is just terribly lonely. And I don't think I even realized how alone I was until I wrote the book. I went back and I read it and I thought, I was terribly isolated. And it's only now that I'm starting to find a community of others in the OCD community and within the poetry community who have OCD, who are willing to support each other and say, yeah, that's exactly what it feels like for me. And that connection has been, for me, so powerful.
How did your life change after a firm diagnosis?
Actually, the idea of a firm diagnosis is a little fuzzy for me because since I kept everything so internal, and also because most of my compulsions and obsessions were mental and other people weren't necessarily recognizing it in me. No one brought me to therapy or identified it for me. I just knew something was wrong. And I don't know how, but somehow I ended up with a copy of Dr. Judith Rapoport's 1991 book, The Boy Who Couldn't Stop Washing. And I think I was probably 16 and just driving at the time when that book fell into my hands. The very first case study in that book is about a man who worries that he might have run over someone with his car. And he's wondering, am I sure I didn't drive over someone with my car? I don't know. It's something about OCD causes you to lose your faith in your own memory and in your own experience. That's why sometimes we hear about people with OCD checking, did you turn off the stove? Checking, did you lock it? Because as soon as you do it, you think, did I really do that? And I had that very idea driving, you know, as a 16-year-old. Did I really kill somebody? How do I know that I didn't? You know, there's this doubt. OCD has long been called the doubting disease, you know, and that's really what it is. So I knew all the things that I had been experiencing, those were OCD. That explained it for me. And I was just sure that I had this. And so I did a lot of self-help books over the years. And again, I think it was just the stigma and the secrecy that kept me from finding therapy. I did seek therapy for conditions that go along with OCD, like depression and anxiety. Cognitive behavioral therapy can be very helpful, but for OCD, it needs to be something specifically targeted, like a cognitive behavioral therapist who understands OCD or exposure and response prevention therapy.
We're talking about a new poetry collection called Exploding Head. Madison-based poet Cynthia Marie Hoffman is here, and you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question, share comments at 800-642-1234. Stephen in Madison now. Stephen, hi.
Hi, Cynthia.
Hi, Stephen. Thanks for
So,
calling in.
oh yeah, I would love to. So I'm someone that is more newly diagnosed with OCD. I found out recently from my psychiatrist it takes on average 17 years from onset of symptoms to diagnosis. For me, it was a big, oh, so that's what that is kind of moment. I still personally feel a little unequipped to write about it, and I'm wondering how it's affected your writing, and specifically if you feel like it gets in the way of your ability to write. Or does it help in some way?
Thank you, Stephen. That's a great question. Cynthia.
That is a great question. By the way, this is Stephen Espada Dawson calling in. He is our Madison Poet Laureate and
Oh,
also has
wow.
OCD. Thank you so much, Stephen, for sharing that with us. I think OCD gets in the way of writing in the same way that it gets in the way of my life. I have this obsessive need to just read things over and over again after I've written them. And it's sad. I often think, how much could I have accomplished in my life if I didn't have to read this email I've already sent 5 or 10 or 15 more times after sending it? I could just send it and move on with my day. And in some ways, that obsessive rereading helps with revision. It really causes me to be extra tuned into the musicality of language and the rhythm of it. I read things in my mind. When I'm practicing my poetry and I'm revising, I read things out loud and hear it. But as far as writing about OCD, it isn't anything I thought of doing until I was 35. It took me, I wrote three other full-length collections before I thought of truly writing about myself.
I wonder, is your do you set aside time then to write like an exercise that you do each day with your writing and poetry? Or do you just decide that, it strikes you in the moment where you sit down and work on a new collection?
Well, I think as poets, we're often taught or we hear the message that we wait for the muse to arrive. And I think that poets could really benefit from the philosophy of novelists who just sit in the chair. And something that has kept me sitting in the chair and showing up for my own creativity and my own work is having a poetry community around me and having a poetry group that I'm sharing work with. Because for a while, in fact, I didn't, for a period of about 5 years, I wasn't writing at all. And I didn't have a poetry group at that time. And my friends started up a new group, and I said, well, I'm not writing, but I'll join anyway. And all of a sudden, you have a peer saying, when's your poem? Where's your poem? You
The
need a poem for next
accountability.
Thursday. Exactly. So it's truly helpful. And if you show up for your work, then the muse will arrive.
The theme of guilt comes up in some of your poetry. Can you explain a little bit more about such feelings of guilt?
I think that that probably just comes from OCD, and it's something where you have a feeling of guilt that just shows up out of nowhere, and then your mind responds to that sensation in your body and says, what have I done? What have I say this in one of the poems in my book, what have you done? And I don't think I could ever come up with the answer. When I was a child, I had these terrible dreams that I had murdered someone. And again, I think it goes back to that Judith Rapoport book and that case study where you start to think, am I sure I know what I've done? And OCD for many years was known as like scrupulosity. So really, really wanting to be perfect and to be good and worrying about sinning too much. And so I think that that really showed itself for me in my OCD as well.
poet Cynthia Marie Hoffman of Madison focuses her new collection on her journey with obsessive compulsive disorder from childhood to adulthood. It's called Exploding Head, and we're discussing these poems. Be part of the discussion at any point. You can call in with a question. You can share your thoughts along the way. The number is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new book of evocative prose poetry. It chronicles a childhood onset and an adult journey through obsessive-compulsive disorder, a mental health condition characterized by obsessions and compulsions that interfere with life, with living. Be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. Share your views at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Madison poet Cynthia Marie Hoffman's new collection is called Exploding Head. Cynthia, can you read a poem for us, Exploding Head Syndrome, and if you could share that poem with us?
Sure. Exploding Head Syndrome. You are finally an adult, living with roommates in a house with a rickety banister and soft spots in the floor when your head begins exploding at night. First, a swish like a heavy wing dragging across the air, and then the door slams. Where does one life end and another begin? When you were a child, your thumb or your mother's thumb was slammed in the car door. One of you felt the pain, one of you the guilt. But you cannot remember which was which. You often dreamed of a guilt so grave you fell to your knees in the garden. Tadpoles shuddered in their leafy beds. What have you done? Once, a red balloon sailed to the ceiling of a warehouse, and though the ribbon slipped from your or your sister's fingers, you cannot remember which. You know the empty hand. You are always running from the shadow that chases you. In the forest at night, an owl screams a womanly, murderous scream. Neighbors call the police. You and your sister and your mother set out with the dog and a flashlight and find nothing.
Oh, thank you so much for sharing that. Why did you choose this poem to share the title of your book?
It's funny because as I look at this collection, Exploding Head Syndrome, the title of this book, Exploding Head, is really the only syndrome or disorder that's diagnosed by name in the book. I don't say obsessive compulsive disorder anywhere in the poems themselves, but Exploding Head seemed to me like it encapsulated that feeling of your head is so packed full and it's so busy with these obsessions and these mental compulsions. It just felt to me like it summarized the experience of OCD in a way.
You describe these poems as memoir in prose poems. Have you always written in prose?
I wrote stories when I was little and essays when I was a little older. And at some point I decided I'm a poet. You know, poems have line breaks. Poems are written in form, et cetera.
They rhyme.
Right. Well, mine don't.
But yes, no.
they often do rhyme. So I think that I finally, as the years went on as a poet, fell back into the prose form. And I have a poem in the book called The Music of Language. Is opening up for you. The music of language is clamping down hard. And it's about my experience with OCD forcing me to grip onto little patterns of things that people say that have a certain number of syllables. They'll just hear, oh, that has six syllables. And that works if I look at the window pane and I count the four sides of the window and I draw an X through the middle. And I have this, you know, compulsion to repeat these phrases based on their musicality. And I think that that caused me as a young child to pay attention to language. And so in a way, OCD, I think, has given me the gift of poetry.
The book, it being written using the personal pronoun you and not I, why do you choose to use you?
I have a poem in the beginning of the book that says, "You are not you again today." And I think that that is kind of summarizing this sense that there's the OCD reality that we live in, which is kind of the not you. It's not truly who I am. It's a big part of me, but it's not my identity.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of my identity. And then there's the you, the true me who lives in the world. And I think also you is a way of creating a distance between myself and the subject. And when I first started writing these poems, it was just a more comfortable place for me to talk about, in a way, someone else and this other part of me that I had never shared before.
You mentioned religion and growing up in a spiritual community. And when I think about religion as well, there are rituals in religious services, a lot of rituals. How does that aspect affect living with OCD and in your poetry?
You're right. There are a lot of rituals associated with religion. And I don't think that my upbringing was religious enough to have brought a lot of those rituals into the home.
Mm-hmm.
But I do remember, of course, praying every night and saying, if I die before I wake, etc. And I think that that's probably a part of what brought the angel into my room as well. This idea that you spend the night before you go to bed connecting with a spiritual entity and connecting with God or an angel or whatever my concept was at the time.
Well, how did that make you feel, that connection before trying to fall asleep? Was that helpful or harmful?
I think it was harmful. It was definitely terrifying. I don't, mm-hmm. you know, that prayer that we say, it really calls to mind the idea that you might die before you wake up the next morning. You know, mm-hmm. I was a kid. I was already pretty in tune with poetry and language and the meaning of things. And that didn't get past me. That wasn't just something I recited. I felt that in my soul every night that I might die. And so I think that, again, I think that probably, you know, conjured the angel in my mind in some way, that I was making a connection to something spiritual that was scary.
New poetry book, Exploding Head. We're talking with Madison Bay's poet, Cynthia Marie Hoffman. You can join in with your questions. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. The book guides the reader through a series of thoughts and perspectives as well as experiences. And one poem is titled, "This Is All True," and includes like this list of experiences that are written almost like instructions. What is this poem about?
So "This Is All True" is kind of, you're right, instructions for Cynthia Marie Hoffman's OCD. It's a list of all the things or some of the things that were compulsions or concerns for me. And I think that this poem in particular, some of the lines are, if your foot dangles off the edge of the bed, a metal blade rises from the floor and slices it off. How do you know you haven't murdered someone accidentally? Look directly at the sun, touch your eyeball once a day. These are all kind of, you know, OCD rules that are made up when I was a child. And I think that this poem kind of says, when I say this is an OCD memoir in prose poetry, or this is an OCD poem, I've been saying that and kind of announcing it as my elevator pitch for this book, imagining that that creates automatically a rich, full understanding in others of what an OCD poem might be. But I'm learning the more, or I'm reminded the more that I talk about this book, that there's a great misunderstanding about what encompasses OCD, what OCD can possibly be. You know, as Jenny said earlier, it manifests itself so differently in different people. So people might not know that for me, an OCD poem means violence, terror.
You write how blinking is very powerful, and you say blinking seven times memorizes the faces of the people you love. You write about blinking more in the beginning, in the childhood section. Does blinking become less powerful as the book progresses?
It does. And in fact, that was probably the one thing that I would say was a visible external OCD compulsion, where I have another poem in the book called The Face Has Seven Holes that has kind of instructions for drawing a star on people's faces by blinking on their eyes and their mouth and their ears. And that was something that I used to do when I was a child. So you would be talking to me and I would be drawing a star on your face, blinking seven times. And people noticed. And one time in school when I was little, we were playing volleyball and I got hit in the face by the ball, volleyball. Not good with ball sports. And my eyes swelled up and I went to the nurse and someone said, you know, your eye is swollen. Is that why you're blinking so much? And I thought, oh, yes, people are noticing this. That was the first time that I was aware that my compulsion was visible to others. And I knew I didn't want other people to know. So I worked really hard at replacing that compulsion with something else, patterning or counting internally in order to hide.
Let's talk about the counting. And I'm just wondering, you know, counting, it comes up. You write, such a waste, hours lost to counting the window panes in this room. Can you explain the issues with counting and how you write about it in the poem?
Yeah, I also have another poem called It Starts that talks about introducing the concept of counting when I was a child. And I always would look at the window and count the four sides of the window. So right, left, top, bottom. And if you kind of draw that pattern on the window, right, left, top, bottom, it makes a four. And for some reason, OCD makes up its own rules. So four is good. You know, some things feel right, some things are wrong, and four is a good number for me. And so it just feels, when you're worried about something, OCD comes in with a compulsion to say, this is how you settle your fears. This compulsion is a ritualistic kind of settling for you. It helps with the anxiety. But over the years, the compulsions become the problem. You know, it's not even so much the fear but and the anxiety. It's the fact that I'm counting all the time. What could I accomplish if I wasn't doing that?
There's a line, like, there's a sort of grace in it, after all, counting yourself lucky to be alive. It sounds like you give a little bit of reprieve in that moment, allowance for the counting.
I think so, because this has been something that I dealt with on my own for so long. I learned to sort of adjust to it and keep it as a part of myself that I was able to see some good in. You know, OCD has made me who I am. It's affected my creativity in positive ways. I see and hear things because of OCD that I wouldn't see and hear if I didn't have it.
Madison poet Cynthia Marie Hoffman's collection of poems is a glimpse inside the inner world of a life with obsessive compulsive disorder. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore a Madison poet's deeply personal and decades-long struggle with obsessive-compulsive disorder, where a person gets caught in a cycle of obsessions and compulsions. Call in with a question. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Cynthia Marie Hoffman's new collection of poetry is called Exploding Head. Toward the end of your collection, you have a poem. It's titled A Great Many Things. Can you read this poem for us?
Sure. A Great Many Things. In the bath, a galaxy of bubbles collapses in a weightless, glittering mound, marking the end of another day in which you are not dead. Your body and all its invisible particles stitched tightly together. Sink deeper into this warm, white cradle, weary from the rattling of your own mind. At dusk, walking through the field, you picked a feather from the grass and ran its shimmering vein between your knuckles. You wanted to see how it was held together by peeling apart its hooks and barbs. There was a hush about it, the swish of hands releasing their grasp. You saw how easily the delicate design of the world can be undone. But for now, you are safe in this watery embrace. Each alternate universe bursts around you one by one, releasing a held breath. A great many things will happen to you, but none of the things you're afraid of. It was the wind in your hair, the red-winged birds embroidering the blue sky. That has been your life.
There's this exhale after reading that poem, like, oh, okay. You know, with the safe in this watery embrace, there's a more peaceful tone than some of the poems that came before. What do you think elicits this feeling of safety?
For me, actually, this feeling of safety and this tone that you referred to is something that I discovered over the course of writing the book and, in fact, assembling the book. It was late in the years that I spent writing these poems that I thought, let me just try it in chronological order. Let me just put all the childhood poems first and the later poems later and see how it reads. And when I sat down and read my own work that way and looked at my own life, I found that the childhood years were very scary, very lonely. And the later years, the later poems, I was naturally adopting a tone of self-compassion. I had learned to care for myself, to reassure myself that, hey, I'm safe. All these things that I've worried about, those are not the things that have happened. That was not your life. Even though you spent many hours and days and years over the course of your life imagining horrible things happening, that was just in your mind. You're truly safe. And so that's sort of something that I discovered and found other ways of self-care. Like, for example, this poem takes place in the bathtub, right? A bubble bath. What, you know, it's this nice, warm water. And thinking of just, you know, where can you find places in your own life where you feel safe and protected.
Hmm. Let's go to Jason in Janesville. Jason, hi.
Yes, I have a question. When you noticed your OCD, or even your parents or adults noticed your OCD was kind of an issue or kind of rearing its head through, did they try to put you on medication or try to, were you able to see this, solve this issue naturally?
Jason, thank you. Yeah, Cynthia.
That's a great question, Jason. My personal story, and I can't speak for others or make recommendations, of course, but I can only speak to my own lived experience. I would say it was more natural as far as the OCD. Cognitive behavioral therapy is something that I had sought for depression and anxiety. And that, even though it wasn't targeted specifically for OCD, it helped me make peace with my thoughts. And remember that as long as I don't react to the thoughts, as long as I recognize that the thoughts are just thoughts and they can't harm me, it's not reality. That was the way that I naturally found a safe space for myself with OCD. I did seek medication for anxiety and depression, and those are all things that kind of come along with OCD. I think we're there because of the presence of OCD. So targeting OCD as the base, I think, is what ultimately helped me feel better.
How has motherhood influenced your poetry?
Well, I think that motherhood is such a big part of my life. I have a child. They're 14 years old now, teenager, but over the course of this book, they were really little, you know, a toddler. And as far as OCD, that child that I was suddenly responsible for kind of just clicked right into place with all my other OCD worries. It was yet another person that I loved deeply that OCD made me worry about losing. And so my child does appear quite a bit in the book. And motherhood, I think, is impossible not to write about because it's part of my identity.
So where does your poetry take you next? Where, you know, after this collection and we think about those last words in the bubble bath, you know, where does your poetry go next?
Well, I'm in that place of figuring out what's next. I tend to write, and I think also because of OCD, I have kind of an obsessive personality. And I love to think of crafting a book rather than poem by poem. So I love what we would call in the poetry world project books. You know, this book is on a theme. My previous three books were all on their own theme. I enjoy the act of building a world. So I'm kind of feeling around for the next obsession. I'm writing a little bit about climate change, a little bit more about being the mother of a teenager, and we'll see where that takes me.
What are your suggestions, advice for other poets or people who are in other artistic pursuits as they also navigate an anxiety disorder?
I think just, again, self-compassion and recognizing, you know, I'm a perfectionist, and it wasn't even until recently finding more of an OCD community that I recognized perfectionism as a kind of symptom of OCD. I just thought, oh, I'm a perfectionist. So recognizing that and allowing yourself to just remember that life is messy, make a mess, you know, just allow yourself to be creative and make mistakes and experiment.
Life is messy and experiment. And yet, I wonder, does poetry create some order for you?
Oh, it absolutely does. Even within the prose poem, which is kind of a disordered order, a prose poem, for those who might not know, is just a paragraph. Mm-hmm. It looks like a little piece of prose, you know, just like reading a memoir. And even in that space, I love the structure of the sentence, the musicality of how it builds and then falls. And it is a very lovely orchestrated space in which to express yourself.
Cynthia, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for sharing your works.
Thank you for having me this morning, Kate.
Cynthia Marie Hoffman is a poet and author in Madison. Her new poetry collection is called Exploding Head. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. 75 years ago, a mayor from Minneapolis challenged the Democratic Party to take action on civil rights and fight racism and anti-Semitism. We explore the rise of Hubert Humphrey's political career and how to view his fight for equality and justice in respect to politics now. Call in with a question, share a comment at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Samuel Friedman is a journalism professor at Columbia University, has been a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award, a graduate of UW-Madison. New book is called Into the Bright Sunshine, Young Hubert Humphrey in the Fight for Civil Rights. Sam, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. It's so great to be here with you. A real honor.
Your book, focusing on the struggle for racial and democratic equality in the 40s, why is it important to explore this era, this period now?
That's a great question. One of the main reasons is that when people think about the civil rights movement and often write about it, there's this assumption that it starts in the middle of the 1950s with the Brown versus Board of Education decision by the Supreme Court that outlaws school segregation, with Rosa Parks and Dr. King and the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955. But you really couldn't have the civil rights landmarks of the 1950s and all the subsequent struggle and achievement if you hadn't had this fervent decade of activism in the 1940s, a lot of which is really inextricably bound up with World War II and with the concept of defeating fascism abroad and then dealing with the unfinished agenda of inequality in America itself.
Hubert Humphrey, elected mayor of Minneapolis in 1945. Can you set the scene for us? What was the racial climate like in the Midwest at that time?
Minneapolis itself, people should disabuse themselves of the idea of Minneapolis as a blue city then, and in some ways even now, but certainly then. Minneapolis was notorious nationally as a hotbed of anti-Semitism and racism. It was a city that had been very welcoming to pro-Nazi sentiments in the form of groups like the Silver Shirts and individuals like Gerald L.K. Smith, founder of the America First Party. It was a place in which Blacks, yes, were able to work, but only in fairly servile occupations, where if they tried to move out of their ghetto on the north side of Minneapolis, there are numerous instances of their homes being besieged and really terrorist mobs
like
trying to
what
drive
happened
them
to
out.
Arthur Lee. I mean, you describe in such detail about what Arthur Lee's family went through in Minneapolis.
Right. Arthur Lee is a World War I veteran, works at the post office, buys a home in an otherwise white sort of middle-class, lower-middle-class neighborhood in South Minneapolis in the summer of 1931. And night after night through that summer, thousands of people besiege his house. They poison the family dog. They vandalize the house. They throw such a fear into the family that the Lee's daughter needs a police escort, even a couple months later when the school year starts, to go to kindergarten. So, you know, these were not anomalies in Minneapolis. These were very normative and very accepted by the mainstream of Minneapolis society. And that's the world that Humphrey takes on. Now, he's not the first person, of course, to fight these battles. And in fact, he learns important lessons from Jews and Blacks and Catholics in Minneapolis who've been trying to take on bigotry in the previous decades. But those people have been fundamentally powerless. They're outnumbered in a city that's overwhelmingly Protestant, Northern European, Scandinavian, British Isles. Humphrey is the first person to really come into the city and provide both political ambition and political skills to the cause of fighting for equality.
Sam Friedman is the author of the new book, Into the Bright Sunshine, as we talk about the push for civil rights after World War II. And get your questions and insights along the way. Call in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sam, another person central in your book is Cecil Newman, the founder and publisher of the Minneapolis Spokesman and the St. Paul Recorder. What is important about Newman?
Cecil Newman is Hubert Humphrey's conscience on matters of race. Humphrey would not have done what he did on civil rights, I think, without the influence of Cecil Newman. Cecil Newman was a former Pullman Railroad porter, which was sort of a Black middle-class occupation at that time, and he took the money he saved being a porter to found a couple of newspapers, most importantly, as you said, the Minneapolis Spokesman and St. Paul Recorder. He's founded them in the mid-1930s, and Cecil Newman is absolutely tireless in using the pages of his newspapers to call out all the different versions of racism that pervaded Minneapolis, everything from labor unions that wouldn't have Black members, breweries that wouldn't hire Black workers, the mainstream newspapers using coded language and writing about Black life, so that invariably the coverage was only about crime when it dealt with Black people. And Newman was just all over this. He also addressed national politics as well. And he was very unimpressed by Franklin Roosevelt on matters of race. So Cecil Newman was not the only activist in Minneapolis. There were others, including a really exceptional civil rights lawyer named Lena Olive Smith. But Cecil Newman, in some way, was the most prominent figure trying to fight this battle and trying to call attention to it. And in some ways, waiting and waiting and waiting for someone like Hubert Humphrey to finally show up on the scene, someone who was not only possessed of a conscience, because there were white people of conscience who Newman interacted with, but someone who had a conscience and had political power.
I was wondering, you know, what did Newman see in Humphrey, and how did Newman know that Humphrey was authentic about his, you know, about his platform to really, you know, change the course for human rights and civil rights?
A great question. One thing that's important to know, and we can talk more at length about this later, is that when Humphrey really starts his career in public life in Minneapolis in late 1940, he's come straight from a year of graduate school at Louisiana State. Mm-hmm. And during that year in Baton Rouge, he'd been immersed in a Jim Crow society for the first time. And it just offended his moral sensibilities. And a lot of people would come north and say, well, I'm really glad I'm out of the benighted South now. And that was sort of Minneapolis's complacent sense of itself. But Humphrey is different. He takes what he saw in Baton Rouge, and it gives him clear eyes for the first time to see the racial inequalities and the bigotry in Minneapolis. And one of his first jobs in Minneapolis is working with the WPA, the New Deal Agency, the Work Progress Administration, initially doing worker education and then war mobilization, basically morale building. And Cecil Newman begins to hear, you know, over the transom that Hubert Humphrey is giving Blacks equal opportunities to get jobs in the WPA, which had not been the case prior to that. Even though there was officially not segregation in Minnesota, the fact was that New Deal programs were administered in a racially unequal way. And Humphrey is defying that. And Newman begins to hear about that. And Humphrey does things like give speeches at Black churches and at the main settlement house in the Black neighborhood on the North Side. And just shows a willingness to engage that was so utterly rare. And at some point, and I don't know exactly when, but at some point, probably in 1941, 42, 43, Newman and Humphrey begin to meet each other face to face. And Humphrey becomes kind of a regular visitor to Newman's newspaper office. And again, is really learning from him along the way. And that just lays down the foundation. And when Newman starts to write about Humphrey in the pages of the Spokesman, or to have his staff reporters write about him, what he's conveying is that this is someone who has treated us fairly. Hmm. And that in and of itself makes Hubert Humphrey stick out.
Columbia University journalism professor and UW alum Sam Friedman's new book, it's called Into the Bright Sunshine, as we explore the rise of Hubert Humphrey's strong civil rights plank for the Democratic Party 75 years ago. Thoughts on this legacy today. Be part of the conversation at any point. Call in with a question. Share your perspective. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new biography called Into the Bright Sunshine. It examines how Hubert Humphrey was a trailblazer for human rights and dismantling racism. 75 years ago, the Minneapolis mayor and the future presidential candidate for the Democratic Party made the case for a strong civil rights plank. And as we explore how this history connects to politics today, you can call in with a question or a comment along the way. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Columbia University journalism professor and author Sam Friedman is here, also a UW-Madison alumnus. Sam, backing up to World War II, many African Americans fighting for the United States. How were these Black veterans received when they returned home from the war?
Kate, it's a great question. And I want to work to the answer by first talking about what the ideology was and the hopes of the Black GIs who went into the war. there was a slogan called Double V that was put together by the great Black newspaper, the Pittsburgh Courier, and it stood for double victory. And the idea was, we're going to fight on behalf of this country that at best treats us as second-class citizens, sometimes barely treats us as human at all. And we're going to make our sacrifices in the war against fascism, which included, of course, concepts of racial superiority, Aryan superiority. And then we're going to come back on the home front and leverage what we did on behalf of this country to ask this country to finally make good on its promise of equality to us. That was the concept of double victory. And it was incredibly influential. And by the way, Jewish GIs didn't have a term like double V, but they'd exacted the same concept. But these Black veterans come back, and the spectacle of a Black man in the uniform of the United States military coming back to a Southern town and making a point of registering to vote, or coming in the front door of the restaurant, or sitting in the front rows of a bus, is absolutely intolerable to the white supremacists of the South. And so what you have are a wave of attacks, some of them fatal, against Black veterans in the South. And the one that probably becomes most known and really ends up affecting Harry Truman himself is an attack on a returning Army sergeant named Isaac Woodard, who's pulled off a bus in the South Carolina town, and the town sheriff gouges his eyes out. And Woodard, to his credit, then goes around the country speaking about the need to desegregate the military and about the broader civil rights agenda. He becomes this national symbol of race hate in America. And the idea that this would happen to a war veteran is an attempt to sort of shame the country into doing better. And as I said, this is an episode that comes to Harry Truman's attention. And Truman, up to this point, has had no particular interest in civil rights. But there's something about him, I think a little similar to Lyndon Johnson later, that he is a conscience that can be affected by individual incidents like this. And it gets him to start to move forward on civil rights.
Southern Democrats opposed civil rights legislation, opposed anti-lynching laws. Can you explain the Democratic Party's dynamic on civil rights issues in the 1940s?
I'm really glad you asked, because it'll be such a shock and revelation to a lot of listeners today. But the New Deal coalition assembled by Franklin Roosevelt had some of the expected components. It had college-educated intellectuals. It had Jews and Catholics from big cities who were from immigrant families. It had organized labor. But then it had this one wing that seems completely contradictory, which was the segregationist Democratic Party in the South. But because the Civil War was associated with the Republican Party and Abraham Lincoln, and so was emancipation and Reconstruction, the white supremacists of the South all flocked into the Democratic Party. And FDR made this calculation, which I would say is almost literally a devil's bargain, that he would appease and placate the segregationist wing of the party because he felt like he needed the votes from those Southern states to win in the Electoral College to be elected to the White House. And he needed the support of these very senior, high-ranking Southern senators and representatives in Congress to move New Deal legislation through Congress. And what FDR offered in return was some New Deal programs like Social Security were written to exclude agricultural and domestic workers, which was to say 90% of working Blacks in the South. All New Deal programs were administered locally, which meant that if you had a Jim Crow state, you would administer the Civilian Conservation Corps or the WPA or the PWA or rural electrification in a racially unequal way. And when it came to the party's platform, FDR made sure that there was no language explicitly endorsing civil rights. He did this, by the way, in spite of the fact that the First Lady, Eleanor Roosevelt, was a fervent advocate for civil rights. And even with her advocacy, FDR wouldn't move on it. And so the language about civil rights in the platform was always fuzzy and vague and equivocal. And the idea was that it would allow the segregationists to interpret it as allowing them what they called states' rights. states' rights was a euphemism that basically meant if the Constitution itself doesn't say that the southern states and the whole country must be racially equal, then every state gets to make up its own mind. And we've made up our mind that we're going to have a Jim Crow system. And FDR was willing to tolerate that in order to be elected. And actually, heading into the 1948 convention, Harry Truman, who of course became president after FDR's death in 1945, Harry Truman is willing to operate on the same playbook, even though it goes against what had been some of his own recommendations on civil rights.
Sam Friedman, author of the new book, Into the Bright Sunshine, as we discuss the push for civil rights after World War II. And you can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Bringing in a bit of Wisconsin here, you write about Andrew B. Miller, who represented Wisconsin in the House of Representatives. What role did B. Miller have in the civil rights movement of the 1940s? And what influence did B. Miller have on Humphrey?
Great question, Kate, because he's really one of the unsung heroes. If Humphrey hasn't gotten nearly enough credit for what he did on civil rights in the 1940s, then Andrew B. Miller is even more obscure to almost everybody. And as you said, he was a member of Congress from Milwaukee. He'd also been a labor activist. He, early in his career, had been part of the progressive movement, the La Follette movement in Wisconsin, and served in the state legislature. The really important thing that B. Miller does is that the 1948 Democratic Convention, the big issue is going to be civil rights. And the insurgent liberals within the party, including Humphrey, have to figure out how they're going to be able to get this issue before the whole convention. And one of the ways that Southerners has held great power in Congress and in the Democratic Party is that a lot of them became very expert in these abstruse rules of parliamentary procedure that the party used.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't Robert's Rules of Order. It was a variation on it that was even less common. And Andy Bing Miller, when he was in Congress, decided to learn these rules inside and out. He learned them from Sam Rayburn, the Speaker of the House. And so when the insurgents are trying to pass their civil rights plank in 1948 against Truman's opposition, with the Southerners threatening to walk out, and they lose at the committee level, they lose at the platform committee, in order to take it before the whole convention delegates, Andy B. Miller knows exactly how to play the rules in order to give Hubert Humphrey the opportunity to speak. And when B. Miller goes and presents, you know, all the backup number of sponsors and so forth to Sam Rayburn that'll allow Humphrey to speak, Rayburn is just flummoxed. He says the fat's in the fire now, which is a cliche that means there's going to be a big blaze. But that's what B. Miller was able to do, is to give Humphrey the opportunity to give the speech, which would become so famous and so influential. Without what B. Miller was doing deep in the weeds of parliamentary procedure, there is no Humphrey speech.
We're going to get into that speech, but you also said B. Miller operated in a precarious middle ground, simultaneously attacked as being too radical, not radical enough, very much what like Humphrey experienced.
Absolutely. At this time, you're getting the emergence of what's going to ultimately be called anti-communist liberalism. And what it means is that there are people like Humphrey, B. Miller, a group called the Americans for Democratic Action, which Humphrey was very involved with, individual senators like Paul Douglas from Illinois, for instance, who are absolutely liberal in terms of the social safety net, who are absolutely liberal in favor of civil rights. But because they've broken with not only members of the Communist Party, who are small in number, but people who are part of what was called the Popular Front, people who were sympathetic to the U.S.-Soviet alliance in World War II.
That puts them in a difficult position. Pausing there with Sam Friedman, author of Into the Bright Sunshine. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine Hubert Humphrey's early efforts to advance a civil rights platform in the Democratic Party and how Humphrey's work 75 years ago connects with struggles against racism and inequality today. Be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. Share your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Columbia University journalism professor and UW-Madison alum Sam Friedman's new biography is called Into the Bright Sunshine, Young Hubert Humphrey and the Fight for Civil Rights. Sam, take us to the 1948 Democratic Convention in Philadelphia. Why was Humphrey invited to speak?
Well, the 1948 convention in Philadelphia is going to nominate Harry Truman for president for a full term, which is to the great chagrin of almost everyone in the party. Everyone assumes Truman is going to be defeated. He's very unpopular at this point. So the big drama and the big looming battle of the convention is whether the Democratic Party is finally going to endorse civil rights. And you have kind of four, four factions, you know, bringing their political might into the convention. You have liberal insurgents, including Hubert Humphrey, who want the civil rights plank. You have Southern segregationists led by Strom Thurmond and the governor of Mississippi, Fielding Wright, who have vowed if there's a word of civil rights language in this platform, we're leaving, we're going to run our own candidate for president, and we're going to try to cost Harry Truman the presidency as a result. You have Truman and his people who are saying, we don't want civil rights language. We want to keep the Southerners inside the tent. Let's just do the same vague, equivocal, fuzzy civil rights language that FDR always did. And then literally outside the convention hall, you have the great Black labor and civil rights leader, A. Philip Randolph, leading protest marches as part of a campaign asking young Black men not to register for the draft and not to serve if called up until Harry Truman desegregates the military. Because the fact that after defeating fascism, America's own army is still racially segregated has become maybe the top line civil rights issue in the entire country at this point. Hmm. So all these factions, all these constituencies are coming into battle during this week in mid-July 1948 in Philadelphia. And the plan for the insurgents is to try to introduce a plank that, as it ultimately does, will explicitly say the Democratic Party supports desegregating the military. We want anti-lynching legislation passed. We want an end to the poll tax. And importantly, Kate, the language of that plank ultimately also says that the protection from discrimination, the guarantee of equality, should be along the lines of not only race, but also religion and national origin. So this plank is also tremendously important to American Jews, to American Catholics, to Japanese Americans who are just coming out of having been incarcerated by their own country during the war, by the growing Mexican-American population, indigenous Americans. So this is a broadly important part of the Democratic platform if the insurgents can get it through. And that's the big question of this week in Philadelphia.
And your book takes its name from a line of Humphrey's speech at that 1948 convention, and we're going to listen to some of it.
To those who say that we are rushing this issue of civil rights, I say to them, we are 172 years late. To those who say that this civil rights program is an infringement on states' rights, I say this. The time has arrived in America for the Democratic Party to get out of the shadows of states' rights and to walk forthrightly into the bright sunshine of human rights.
You hear a mixture in that speech of boos in the background. What was your immediate reaction to the speech?
Well, exactly right. You can't help, at least if you're constructed politically the way I am, to be stirred and moved by Humphrey's passion and eloquence. But you're also taken aback right away by the fact that the boos kind of outshout the cheers. And that is really important for people to listen to, because we shouldn't think that Hubert Humphrey was taking on some safe, pallid, middle of the road issue. He was out there walking the plank, and the Southern reaction to it was a sign that the party was going to split over this issue, which indeed happened. And just to jump ahead, when Humphrey later made it into the Senate, the Southern senators there, who had far more seniority than he did, took it out of his hide every way they could, which is something Robert Caro writes about in his, you know, extraordinary multi-volume Lyndon Johnson biography. So Humphrey knew that he was taking great risk here, and the boos were in a way the most obvious part, but the other risk he was taking was defying Harry Truman. Truman's people weren't going to boo Humphrey, but privately, before Humphrey gave that speech, one of the senators who was a point person for Truman on the convention said to Humphrey in so many words, if you give this speech, your political career is over. Humphrey, in a committee hearing, was called a pipsqueak. Harry Truman's writing in his diary of the civil rights forces within the Democratic Party that they're crackpots. He uses that term explicitly for Andrew B. Miller and extends it to everybody else on the civil rights side. And Humphrey's just a kid, really. He's 37 years old. He's only been in elected office for 3 years, and it's been as a mayor of a mid-sized city. Because he lost so much time during college to the Great Depression and having to drop out and help his family economically survive, this guy hadn't even gotten his bachelor's degree until he was 27 years old. And here he is only 10 years later, daring to address the entire nation. I'm sorry, 60 million people listening on radio, 10 million watching on TV. It's like the Super Bowl.
What an orator. I was struck just by how his words and what he put together in his speeches. What was his way of writing a speech?
Humphrey, at least with this speech, he spoke it out. He had pulled an all-nighter in his hotel in Philadelphia with some of his closest allies and aides. And someone was jotting down notes as Humphrey was basically speaking out what would be the text. Then it was typed, and then Humphrey was self-editing it. And you can see the copy of the speech that's in the Minnesota Historical Society, his penciled in notes all along, what words to emphasize, what phrases to change. And so this is 95% Humphrey's work. And by the way, those wonderful passages you played, the lines about 172 years too late and walking into the bright sunshine, Humphrey had been trying out those phrases in previous speeches for almost a year. He'd been polishing them and burnishing them and slightly altering them, trying to get them exactly right, which he did in this speech. And the speech goes for just 10 minutes. And I think that's a big advantage to Humphrey because he tended to talk too long, as many of us remember. And even his wife Muriel once said to him, "Hubert, a speech need not be eternal to be immortal." She really called him on his stuff, and she was right. But this speech, by convention rules, could only be 10 minutes, and that was a big advantage to Humphrey. And he has these great soaring flights of eloquence in it. He also talks about the fact that during the Cold War, the United States can't look like the country of racial inequality and let the Soviet Union look like the country of racial equality when there's this global battle for the political affiliation of these soon-to-be decolonized countries in Africa and Asia and Central and South America. And then the one line that Humphrey doesn't write himself, but that's really dispositive, is given to him by a woman named Eugenie Anderson, who is a Democrat farmer labor party activist from southeastern Minnesota, from Red Wing, and will ultimately go on to actually be one of the first female ambassadors for the United States. And Eugenie Anderson comes up with the idea, we're only saying things in this plank that Harry Truman in the past has himself endorsed, even though he's trying to walk away from his own positions now. So let's just throw our arms around Harry Truman and congratulate him and salute him for what he's done. And it was a brilliant addition to the speech because what it allowed the delegates to say to themselves is, I'm not contravening what Truman wants. I'm voting for what Truman himself has espoused just a year earlier. And all of that together works to win a majority of the delegates on the convention floor. and to get this plank added to the party platform.
Sam Friedman, author of the new book Into the Bright Sunshine, as we look at the push for civil rights after World War II, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Pam is joining us in Verona. Pam, hi. What would you like to ask?
Hi. I had a question about the 1964 Democratic Convention. I saw something on, or I heard something on PBS the other evening about the Mississippi Freedom Party, how it was integrated, and that the regular Mississippi Democratic Party was totally white, and that there was real risk of the Mississippi Freedom Party becoming the Democratic Party at the convention, that LBJ was horrified that he prevailed or urged, insisted that LBJ have the Mississippi, or persuade the Mississippi Freedom Party to accept a compromise where they would get two of, I think, 50 or 60 delegate positions at the convention. Otherwise, LBJ would not select Humphrey as his vice president. I'm wondering if there is context or truth to that claim, that although Humphrey was a civil rights pioneer, that he was, you know, ground under LBJ's heel at this particular junction.
Pam, thank you.
Right. That's, you're broadly correct, and I'll address it in a second. But what's really amazing is that at the 1948 convention, there was something very similar, and hardly anyone knows about this. In 1948, there is a segregated, all-white, pro-Jim Crow delegation from Mississippi, just as there was also in 1964. And in 1948, a group of liberal and moderate, they're all white at this point, but liberal and moderate Mississippians come to the convention and say this segregationist slate of Mississippi delegates should be thrown out of the convention. And the battle overseeing them, which is led by a liberal minister from Mississippi, but is taken to the convention floor by a black civil rights lawyer from St. Louis, nearly wins. And one of the delegates who helps bring that to the floor is Hubert Humphrey's father, who's a delegate from South Dakota. And the fact that this segregationist slate of delegates almost got tossed out in 1948 is happening literally the day before Humphrey's civil rights plank goes through. So it's a sign that there's a lot more sympathy for civil rights in the 48 delegates than had been previously perceived. Jump ahead to 1964, and you're right, Mississippi is still sending a slate of Jim Crow delegates, and the Mississippi Freedom Party, which is mostly black but also integrated alternate party that's in favor of desegregation and civil rights laws, comes to the convention with its slate of delegates and demands that the Jim Crow slate get tossed out. And Johnson's fear is mostly that there'll be a big blow up at the convention and this will hurt his reelection chances that fall. You have to keep in mind, by this time, Johnson, with Humphrey's help in the Senate, has pushed through the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So it's not as if in any way he's trying to dodge civil rights, but he's worried about a big nationally televised row at the convention. And what he does is basically make Hubert Humphrey audition for the position of vice president by going to the Mississippi Freedom Party and saying, you're going to get two delegates out of, I don't know if it was as many as 50, I can't remember the exact number, but you're going to get two delegates. We're not going to put in your whole slate. And that, of course, infuriates the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party at the time. But interestingly, what happens, the long tail of this, is most of the Mississippi Jim Crow delegates walk out anyway. And so most of the Mississippi Freedom delegates actually end up sitting in the convention. And as a result of their challenge to the Jim Crow delegation, the party changes its rules subsequently, and there will never be a segregated slate of delegates allowed in the Democratic National Convention again. So even though it looked like a sellout of the Mississippi Freedom Party at the time, it actually had incredibly positive effects down the road. So I would say that there's a defense that could be made of that compromise.
Columbia University journalism professor, graduate of UW-Madison, Sam Friedman, author of Into the Bright Sunshine, as we examine Hubert Humphrey's early years in politics, seeking to address racism and anti-Semitism. Call in with a question, share comments along the way, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new biography on Hubert Humphrey. It focuses on his early political career, trying to unify the Democratic Party around a robust civil rights platform. And we examine this legacy and hold it in light of racism today. Call in with a question. Share what you think of this history. 800-642-1234. Columbia University journalism professor Sam Friedman's book is called Into the Bright Sunshine, Young Hubert Humphrey and the Fight for Civil Rights. Sam is an alum of UW-Madison. Fast forward to today, former President Donald Trump being the front runner for the Republican nomination next year, despite facing numerous criminal charges. Trump has been supported by neo-Nazi and white supremacist groups. What could the GOP learn from the Democratic Party of the 1940s in confronting extremist elements within its ranks?
Unfortunately, the GOP seems to be committed to refusing to learn the lesson of the Democrats in the 40s. The Democrats were willing, at their electoral peril, to oust a wing of the party that had an ideology that was toxic in light of movements for racial and religious equality in this country. They, you know, at the urging of people like Hubert Humphrey, pushed out a wing of the party. And even though Adlai Stevenson and John F. Kennedy try to bring the Southerners back in, when Lyndon Johnson becomes president, there's a permanent severing, and those people in the white supremacist South become part of the Republican Party of today. And today's Republican Party has obviously refused to reckon with that. It has refused to quarantine and to expel racists, anti-Semites, neo-Nazis, you name it. Everything's about the pragmatism of, can we pull together somehow enough electoral votes to win the White House, even with the minority of the popular vote, or can we just plain have a coup and take power that way? And if, you know, the white supremacists and the neo-Nazis and the Christian nationalists are our allies in that, then that's all we care about.
Humphrey goes on to serve in the Senate and as vice president. And in 68, the Democratic Party nominated him for president during this really contentious convention in Chicago. And let's listen to some of his speech from that 1968 convention.
Are we to be one nation, or are we to be a nation divided? Divided between black and white, between rich and poor, between north and south, between young and old. I take my stand. We are and we must be one nation.
So, Sam, today Humphrey may be best known as an establishment candidate who supported the Vietnam War. What do you see as Humphrey's legacy?
He has to have a two-part legacy, just as we can now see the totality of LBJ. Hubert Humphrey doesn't deserve a free pass for Vietnam. He ultimately acknowledged it was the gravest mistake of his political career, and he should take criticism in the eyes of history for the support of the war. It cost millions of lives here and in Vietnam. But we can't let that crowd out everything else he did. And unfortunately, in the popular memory, it has crowded that out. And here's someone who was probably, with the possible exception of Eleanor Roosevelt, the white person most committed to civil rights through the 1940s and early 1950s. We salute what Lyndon Johnson did as president on civil rights, and it deserves to be saluted. But Hubert Humphrey was on the civil rights issue 10, 12, 15 years before LBJ was, and he did it at a great cost. When he was mayor of Minneapolis, he was almost assassinated by a neo-Nazi who was opposed to Humphrey's, you know, activism against racism and anti-Semitism. What more could you ask than someone almost pay with their life and not be deterred, continue to fight even harder on behalf of an equal America. So we have to remember that when we take stock of Humphrey's entire public life.
When he challenged Lyndon Johnson on an exit strategy on Vietnam, did that compromise his ability to advance his civil rights in the administration, his role in the in administration?
I think like Johnson himself, Humphrey was of two minds about Vietnam. We know from tapes of Johnson that as early as like 1964 and 65, he's confessing his doubts about the whole venture. And similarly, Humphrey, early in his vice presidency, expressed some doubts. Johnson was infuriated about it. But Hubert Humphrey was also a Cold Warrior. Hubert Humphrey was formed by the battles in Minnesota between the anti-communist left and the communist sympathizing left. And he later told George McGovern, a one-time protege who became his adversary in 1972, when they finally did reconcile as friends, he tells McGovern, "Everyone thought I supported Vietnam just to be loyal to Lyndon, but that's not true. I believed in it. I know now I was wrong, but I believed in it then." And I take that as being very credible.
After George Floyd's murder by Minneapolis police, we saw millions of people protesting for civil rights across the nation. What do you think remains of Humphrey's civil rights platform?
It's an unfinished agenda. One of the things that Hubert Humphrey did as mayor and tragically never got to finish because he moved so quickly into the Senate was take on a bigoted, abusive, inbred police force in Minneapolis. And he had a great police chief named Ed Ryan who was helping him in it. In the 1940s, Hubert Humphrey saw the problem and was demoting racist officers. He saw the problem. He was sending the entire police force to get training at the University of Minnesota in what was called human relations. But that agenda ended when he went to the Senate. And even though there have been other reform-minded police chiefs and other very liberal mayors in Minneapolis, the power of the police union has only grown stronger over time.
Sam, and thank you so much for joining us. Sam Friedman, journalism professor at Columbia University, new book called Into the Bright Sunshine. We'll give a talk about the book November 13th in Madison, November 16th in Milwaukee. Find details at wpr.org/mornings. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.